Welcome to Let's Talk Land, weekly talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling and ownership. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant, broker owner of United Country Real Estate. Land Pro is our company. Our office is at 3349 Cook School Road in Pilot Mountain, North Carolina, Highway 52, exit 136 across from Foothills, Hardware and Building Supply. We share office space with Pop Design for all your graphic needs. Our company website is www.mylandpro.com. Give us a call or check out our website. I'm a member of the Realtors Land Institute. We have over 1,300 members nationwide and around 518 was the last count accredited land consultants like myself. And our website, national website, is www.rliland.com, where you can find members and ALCs around the country to help you out. Our guest today is John Shipley, one of my buddies. He's a consulting forester, NC State grad. Grew up in Winston-Salem with a bachelor's in science and forestry management. Welcome, John.
Hey, Lou.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Glad you're here. We want to talk about forestry timber, just to give people an idea. It's really worth something, and it's very important if you're buying or selling land, especially if you're buying because it's an investment. Mm-hmm. I always say if any time you use the word land, you use the word investment. I don't care what it is. It is an investment. And, of course, timber is a crop, just like corn, soybeans, peaches, tomatoes. It's a crop, and mm-hmm. it needs to be managed properly. Soils are important. Location's important. And, of course, the market fluctuates. It's a moving target. It's in the index, and it's moving different timber, different species, or different types of woods. It's moving in terms of value on a daily basis. So you have an interesting profession. How long have you been doing it?
12 years.
12 years, okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your company.
You know, I work typically the western half of the state, and my partners work the eastern half, and we help landowners from small woodlot owners to corporations who own properties, and we manage their timber and timberland properties, and also do land brokers for them as well.
So you're a realtor as well, mm-hmm. and they are as well?
Yep.
And they're located in Raleigh,
yep.
and you're here in Winston-Salem. And you actually do service in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia?
Yep.
Carolina Fauna offers timber management services, including timber sales, forestry management, forestry investment analysis, pulpwood thinning, GIS mapping, and reforestation, right? That pretty mm-hmm. much covers what you do.
Yep.
And we can talk about each of those and what they mean. And your land marketing services, Carolina Forestry, clients range from small wooded lots, as you mentioned, with 10 acres or forest land investors who owns large acreage tract. I was up in Charlotte County, Virginia, looking at, actually they own over 7,000 acres, which is a large tract. I mean, there's a lot of large tracts around, but that's for that part of the world is a very large one.
Mm-hmm.
But they started buying it in 1944, and it's been professionally managed all that time. And I looked at a 5,700-acre tract. The road actually went all the way around it, and some of it was on both sides of the road. And then we went into the internal parts, and the guy I was with said that the Virginia Forestry Service had been there several times because they're trying to sell it to the state to make a resort refuge out of it, wildlife. And he would stop at certain places, and he would say, "You see that timber over there? That's the way timber looked exactly 200 years ago." And the person that actually started buying it brought the loblolly pines to that particular part of the Virginia, has never been there. And they didn't plant it in rows, plantation. They would find spots in the woods where there was a gap and plant one. And some of those trees were 100 foot tall or better, and I couldn't put my arms around them. From 44, some of them. So you can imagine what that was.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't guess you see much of that because people usually want to harvest the money.
Yeah, or it wasn't until like the 60s since we started introducing loblolly. So it would be very uncommon to find that.
Right.
Well,
it may have been 60 when they bought it in 44. Yeah.
It may very well have happened. It just wasn't very popular.
Right. Actually, he was saying some of them were 50 and 60 years old, so that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah.
But they actually introduced the loblolly to that county in Virginia, and it's interesting. And, you know, just real quickly, we were talking when I was on that visit about timber prices, and the loblollies right now, of all the timber species, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, those prices are down, right? A little bit. They're not, they didn't accelerate like your hardwoods and so on.
No.
Or was that,
well,
I misunderstood?
We haven't seen the stumpage prices on yellow pine timber as good as they were in 2005 and 6, because the building, we were building a lot more homes than we are right now, even though the market's great.
Right.
We're still not building as much. Our building prices have changed too. Maybe we're using less of the yellow pine, but yellow pine lumber prices are as good now as they've been the last 10 years.
Really?
So, you know, there's a great upside to it right now.
Right, even your Virginia pines, your scrap pines?
Yeah, because a lot of that goes into OSB.
Right.
That directly goes into housing. And if you ever go to Lowe's now and try to buy a sheet of OSB, you'll notice that the prices are about double what they were 2 years ago.
Is that right? Double?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know the cost of building a home now, you know, you're hearing in different places, it's averaging close to $200 a square foot in some places.
Mm.
It's just hard to find, you know, a builder with the cost of materials has gone up.
And labor shortage. Mm-hmm.
Labor shortage, yeah, there's a lot of things. So our goal today, John, is to help our audience better understand timber, okay? We want to discuss all the methods to establish the health and the value and the marketability of timber tracts. Also, the typical things that you see when cruising, which is the methodology of going out and determining. There's different methodologies that you can tell us about. And some of the unique and usual things that you have experienced. Now, that should be interesting.
Noticing historical sites in the woods is probably the most exciting. You know, seeing old homes and 200-year-old rock dams that were hand-laid.
Right.
And
dikes, old dikes.
You know, seeing old grave sites and old wells and old fences and old signs. And
taking your doggy with you like
Shada. Yeah.
I know when we go out together, Jackson and Shada, of course, Jackson's a lab and Shada's a jack. So Jackson takes one big leap and Shada takes about four.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun to watch. But we got to take our doggies with us.
They do.
They're kind of good companions and help us there. You got one of the finest dogs I've seen. By the way,
thanks.
Highly trained. So, as an independent consulting forester, okay, is trained for professional forestry that operates or works for private business, and then your forestry and your timber dealers often have foresters who assist landowners, and they sometimes term them consultants, right? And then you have the state forestry, right? You have the federal forestry. And they provide different services than what you as a consulting forester does.
Yeah.
Tell me the difference.
So we really don't have any interactions, or I don't have any interactions with the federal U.S. Forest Service.
Right.
Just probably because I don't do any work in the National Forest.
But they have their own foresters, right?
They do. Right. Yeah. So you can work for the U.S. Forest Service managing national forest land.
Okay.
And I just don't work in those areas.
Sure.
Then you have the State Forest Service, which has a big presence in North Carolina. Every county has its own office. We have 100 counties in North Carolina.
Right.
And at least two people work in every office. Then they have regional offices and, you know, state offices. So their responsibility is to protect and educate. And they do a great job at it. And we work alongside of them. With our landowners and our logging crews and sawmills, and everyone tries to do their part and for the better good. And then we have the foresters that work for the sawmills and wood dealers. You know, their primary responsibility is to feed the mill.
Right.
And they're out actively trying to find tracts of timber to buy or deal.
Right.
And supply the pulp mills and sawmills and OSB mills with material. And then you have consulting foresters, basically the last category. And so we are the ones who work for the private landowner. So we typically, you know, we either charge a commission or an hourly fee to conduct, you know, timber sales and management activities. Management activities can range from forestry herbicide to replanting to pre-commercial thinnings, ditching and road maintenance work,
right?
All the way to the the final clear cut harvest. And overseeing that,
signing off when the equipment pulls. You sign on when they come in. You sign off when they leave. Right.
Yep. So most commonly, we hold a what's called a performance bond on a timber buyer who's bought a tract of timber from one of our clients,
right.
And that's held in escrow.
Is that for accidents too?
Well, it's basically there to help enforce the agreement.
Okay.
So if an error arises and they do not fulfill their obligations with the contract, it's there to litigate.
Like an insurance policy, right?
Yeah.
Kind of gives you that.
So that's the last thing any of us would ever want to go into, right. But it's there for protection of the landowner.
Has that happened in your career?
It's happened a couple of times.
Yeah.
So very, very seldomly.
Yeah. Good thing to have.
It is.
So you basically worked for the public for the other. So when you graduated from school, you had an option to go either with the United States Forestry or with the State Forestry or being consulted. That was your
Or work for the mills.
Or work for the mills,
yeah.
Right.
And buyer. I decided to work for the mills.
Oh, is that
because,
how you started?
Yeah. So when I was in college, I interned as a consulting forester.
Really?
So I already kind of got my handle on that side of the business. And then I decided to work for the mills to get an understanding of that experience. And as, luck would have it, I decided to go on my own after a couple of years.
Sure.
And start my own thing. So, and that was 10 years ago,
right.
10 and a half years ago.
Who were you working with when you were doing that?
I was working for a large hardwood sawmill in Wilkes County.
I got you.
And great people to work with. And that's definitely one of the hardwood sawmill capitals of North Carolina.
Is it really?
And there's no other area in North Carolina that has that much hardwood saw timber production.
Hmm.
So they are feeding a large percentage of the hardwoods that go on the market,
right.
Hardwood lumber that hits the market, and a lot of that's exported.
Wow. And so you learned how to grade timber, grade logs, and that was one of the things, because they'll come in a truck. And
just enough to be dangerous.
Yeah.
And
then that's all subjective, isn't it? Experience and subjectivity.
It's easier to grade the log than it is a tree staying on the stump. Because if it's on the stump, you can't see inside the wood,
right?
Whereas if it's a log at the sawmill, at least you can look at the grain.
Right, or see if there's decay in the lot of certain, like
poplar. You can run
stuff.
A melee detector over it. You can see both ends, see if it's got any rot in it, wormholes, staining, what have you. When it's staying on the stump, it's you have to be pretty subjective to try to understand where the knots are, how deep they go, how many are on the... how many sides of the tree those knots are.
Right.
So, if you've got knots on all four sides, well, that's a grade 3 or worse, log. And
what's the grading scale? 1 to 5 or basically?
I guess it depends on the mill, but
right.
Most commonly it's going to be 1 through 3.
Okay.
And
would be like veneer?
Yeah, it could go as veneer.
Right.
Or it could be just sawn for a clear,
And veneer's basically...
number one common.
Veneer is basically a tree that doesn't have a lot of limbs as it grows, so you don't have the...
They all have trees as limbs as they
grow, right.
But the hope is that the trunk is shaded so that it loses its limbs.
Right.
And
at an early
it
stage.
Grows beyond those knots,
right.
In order to produce the clear lumber,
right.
That is desirable for the veneer and grade logs.
Got it. Well, so what else did you learn in your first 2 years other than grading?
Well, probably the most important was, there's probably several, but dealing with landowners, dealing with loggers,
right.
And how to estimate board foot of volume in a forest as it stands. Because
mm-hmm.
That is, at the end of the day, what we are willing to pay for those trees,
right.
What those trees are worth.
And you can be off 10 or 20%, right, plus or minus.
Let's hope not.
But I'm saying you could, right?
Yeah.
But a good expert like yourself, you may be off 3% plus or minus. Possibly.
As a buyer for a mill, you want to be very close within 10%, I would say.
Okay, 10.
And you're catering to that mill. But as a consultant, you're having to cater to a lot of different mills and buyers and different products. So when we cruise, we try to cruise to what's most common. Okay, so.
Anyway, we're talking to John Shipley. This is Lou Jewell with Let's Talk Land. So, John, you know, the first 2 years, that was probably one of the smartest moves you made, don't you think, in your career?
And, yeah,
and
no
getting
kidding.
Grounded as opposed to going out there,
yeah.
You know, with not a lot of experience. And
you got that right. Yeah, so now I can kind of relate to what the buyers are having to deal with.
Right.
You know, they work for the sawmill,
right.
But at the end of the day, we need them in order to sell to.
I mean,
they're a lifeline, and they live a very demanding, very stressful life, and we as consultants need to do everything that we can in order to make their jobs easier.
Talking about the lumber yards or the people that actually cut the trees have the stressful part?
All of them.
Because it's always push for time, right? Money, push,
oh, my gosh. Because, I mean, you got to think about it. So all they have to go by is what their lumber's been selling and what the current market reports say.
Okay.
That market report could change tomorrow.
Really?
And then all of a sudden, they just threw a bid on a tract of timber, 100 acres of hardwood timber, and they just paid $350,000 for it. And they've got a two-year contract to cut it.
Right.
And it can be cut in the wintertime. Maybe it can't. Maybe it's just a summertime job.
That depends on accessibility,
yeah.
Right?
And all of a sudden, the market just crashes.
Yeah.
Like poplar's down 20%. And it will go through major swings.
Right.
I mean, it's not like, you know, Apple or Google stocks that are 1 or 2% here, 3%, whatever. You know, these are typically big swings. I mean, just recently, you know, Red Oak just took a nosedive. Chinese said, you know, we had enough. And prices basically dropped 50% overnight.
Really? And that's one of your higher prices.
But that could change tomorrow.
In any species, right?
You know?
And it might just hit one or two species, but not the whole timber.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because a typical tract of timber that we're selling will have 1 to 3 species that are the most.
Right.
Okay, the most product, maybe within the 80%.
What would they be? 80%. What would they be typically?
Oh, man.
White oak, red
gosh,
oak?
Gosh, you know, it just depends on where I'm selling the timber. You know, I could be up in Caldwell County.
Gotcha.
On the side of a mountain. And 80 to 90% of what I could be selling up there is white pine.
Right.
Here in the Piedmont, it may be poplar, red oak, white oak.
Right.
And those red oak varieties can be five or six different types.
Right.
So I won't get into that.
That's
a whole different
set. We'll do another show.
But exactly. And you know, so then they find a site. Okay, well, let's just start cutting it. All of a sudden, you know, the loggers hit a bunch of wet weather or breakdowns in equipment. They can't get to it. What could have taken a month to cut is now taking 3 months to cut.
So there goes profit.
You know, so their profit, it could go down. They could hit a home run and the profit goes up because the market changed. You know, they're having to pay interest on this money that they're borrowing, you know, that from a line of credit from the bank.
This is a crazy business.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then meanwhile, you know, as a consultant, I'm having to work with the landowner.
Sure.
Holding their hands, trying to say, okay, well, you know, we got a heck of a good bid. Let's just be patient. They've got a 2-year contract. Because that's the first question they'll ask. Right. Is like, when are they going to start? It's like, well, we really don't know. You know, they could call me tomorrow and say, John, we'll be in there the next day.
But some contracts are prepaid, right?
Absolutely. Most of them are.
Right. As soon as you sign that timber deed and it's recorded, then that certified check's in your hand.
Let me back up. So most of what I sell in this part of the state is sold lump sum up front.
Gotcha.
The landowner's getting paid.
And that's probably the best method, right, as opposed to, you know.
No, not necessarily. Because
really?
There's a lot of situations where I'm using pay as cut, and those situations can be, if not more so, advantageous to the landowner.
How would you decide? Market?
It depends on. I'll give you an example. So if I can go into a 20-acre stand of trees and it's all pretty uniform, and I can go in there and count everyone, and I can get a pretty good estimate, is high value trees.
Right.
That's a pretty good cruise, and they're going to sell it lump sum. I don't need to pay as cut. However, it could be a pretty junky stand of Virginia pine, a bunch of storm damage. There's no great way of getting in there.
Right.
Could be a bunch of bay laurel. Really thick, can't get an accurate estimate of what's in there. not to mention it's a cruddy tree,
right.
Not very desirable. The sawmills, they're not that interested in taking a gamble and paying for it up front. If they do, they're going to be very conservative because they can't get an accurate estimate.
Right.
So in that kind of situation, say, let's do a pay-as-you-cut.
Right.
That way we'll get paid exactly what the agreed-upon price is by the week as soon as they start cutting. The downside to that is the lander doesn't get paid till they start cutting.
Mm-hmm. But he gets paid as they deliver,
right? As they deliver, yes, that's right. And it's a little scary for a lot of people, a lot of landowners, because they're like, well, I don't know if they're really cutting what they said they are.
Right.
It's kind of an honor system to it.
Sure.
So we do rely on some security measures in order to make sure that the loads are being accounted for and they're accurate. But
is that something you actually go and check periodically, to spot check to
keep
that honesty factor in?
We have was basically a souped up trail camera, like what deer hunters use, but it's in a steel cage and it's drilled to the side of a tree, and,
right.
and that keeps records of every load that comes off the job.
That's sneaky.
And no, we're not trying to be sneaky.
No, I'm just teasing.
Because the loggers actually appreciate it because their logging jobs are typically vandalized, and it's just one more camera out there that can catch vandals, because believe it or not, it happens a lot to them.
Right.
And they don't mind having someone look over their shoulder because, you know, they're trying to do an honest job, and they're not trying to skimp on loads. And honestly, they get paid by the mills. So they want accurate, you know, representation of their loads too.
Right.
So I haven't had a single logger come up to me and get angry with me because I put a camera on their roads. I'm very upfront with them and try to explain to them what I'm doing. And it seems like
most of them
been working pretty well
around. So, you know, they said, here's John, his camera.
Yeah, exactly.
And his dog.
It hurts though when the vandals go in there to vandalize the equipment and they steal one of your $600 cameras. It's painful, but at the end of the day, it's cheap insurance.
Yeah, it is.
Cheap insurance policy, because I can go back to the landowner and say, hey, here's the loads. Here's the receipts they've given to us from
right.
the mills, and here's the pictures of every load.
Wow. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's a good way of doing it.
Yeah, it is great. You're a great businessman. I've observed this over the years as our relationship is built, and I just want to acknowledge that.
Thank
it's,
you.
You're far ahead of some that I've worked with in the over the years, quite far ahead. So when you do it by the load, and I'm selling the timber, you're my agent, okay? Is it a 50-50, 60-40? That's negotiated, right? How does that work?
I'm not concerned about that. What they are offering to the landowner as a price is all I'm concerned with. What the loggers work out with their employer or the sawmills of the split they want to do, whether they're getting paid by the ton, by the per 1,000 board feet measure, stick rule, whatever, that's up to them. At the end of the day, I want hard figures that this is what they're going to pay the landowner, the net to the landowner.
But there's loggers out there that go and work in the public. They're not working through a forester, and they do this.
They
do. We'll do 60-40 or we'll do. That's scary to me.
It's scary to me, too, and I'll tell you why. So if you've got veneer white oak,
right.
you can get a veneer buyer in there, and they're going to pay $1 to $3 a board foot for those veneer logs,
right.
which means they're getting paid $1,000 to $3,000 per 1,000 board feet.
Wow.
Roughly speaking, that's about 4.5 to 5 loads per 1,000 board feet on a tractor trailer load. So a tractor trailer will hold 4.5 to 5
mm-hmm.
1,000 board feet of veneer logs. One load can be worth that much. One load of pulpwood to the landowner may only be worth $5 a ton.
Right.
Well, $5 times 25 tons, it's only $125.
Yeah.
So that logger doesn't have money on that wood load.
Sure.
Neither does the landowner. However, you have that great variability in there that's going to be hard to keep track of. Than the landowner, they're not in the business of selling trees.
Sure.
You know, so how do they know whether they're getting a good deal or not?
Right.
It comes down to trust.
But that's why they need a professional like you, right? I mean, this offsets that. Yes, they're paying you, and that costs them money too, okay?
Yeah.
You know, I know I'd sold, the last ones I sold several years ago was 39 acres, and Another forester got involved with me, and he charged me 8% to do the seal bid because I auctioned it, and that's another methodology. And where he sent the crews out to 20 or 30 timber buyers, and then, you know, we had an auction, and I took the highest one, obviously. But for his services, he charged me 8% from the time that he did the cruise until the time he finished the assignment, you know, which I wrote off. That was the cost of doing business. It was a lot of money, but it, to me, what he got me for the timber offset, you know, me just calling up Joe Smith down the road that had a sawmill and say, hey, come buy my timber. No telling what I got, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they're... Landowners are going to eventually have to hire us anyway in order to get a cost basis on what they sold. Because at the end of the year, you got to file taxes on the trees that you sold. The biggest mistake I see landowners do with second to not doing the right thing when they first sell the trees is the second most important thing they need to do is file a proper tax return, timber tax form T, stands for timber. You know, they sometimes think that the timber money that they get from the trees is ordinary income. Well, it's not. You know, you have a basis in the trees from when you inherited that property or you bought that property. Prime example, you have 100, let's say you sold 10 acres of trees that are 50 years old. You bought that property 10 years ago. Okay. You sold that 10 acres for $10,000. Theoretically, you should be taxed on $2,000, not $10,000 of income.
Okay.
So, long-term cap gains tax at 15%, short-term cap gains at
your income level. Then if you have a mortgage on it, part of that money's going to go to the lender because you're reducing the asset, and that could be as high as 80%, I've seen.
Yeah.
You know, to reduce that note.
That's another thing landowners need to check with their lenders. You know, a lot of times... You know, it's the lender who owns the deed of trust on the property. So maybe they don't allow, you know, timber harvesting. So got to get that cleared up first and get a release.
What other things should people know about? I think we had some pretty interesting things that we need to talk about, right?
Yeah.
Anything else that comes to mind that the average property owner should...
I can go on.
We could write a book?
Yeah, yes, we could.
Okay. But these are the hard ones, right?
It is.
You know, working with a professional, number one, right, that can guide you through the process, having a relationship with the bank if you have a mortgage on it. If you don't have a mortgage on it, then you don't have to worry about it. And then the third thing is the capital gains that could hit you when your accountant says, you owe $10,000 in taxes, but now that I got this form here, now you owe $18,000 in taxes.
Yeah.
Or whatever that number is.
Sure.
Surprise. Mm-hmm. People don't like surprises, do we, Rodney?
No.
Or Shada doesn't like surprises either. So that's interesting. So the lumberyards, is there more lumberyards out there today than there was maybe when you started, or is that decreasing, or what's going on in the
industry? I'd say there's about the same number of buyers out there. I'm lucky to say that.
But I'm talking about sawmills.
About the same number of sawmills today as when I got started.
And some of these are two and three generations.
And like I'm saying, I'm lucky to say that because when I go out west, you know, a lot of those communities have been devastated by the 2008 recession.
Right.
Some of those mills just shut their doors and
when you're saying out west, you're talking western North Carolina or western United States?
Montana, Idaho, Washington State.
Wow. Yeah. And then the fires.
A lot of those got rocked because... You know, they are very limited in the species that they are going to be cutting.
Right.
Their softwoods, especially, is their main market in a lot of cases. I mean, we've got here in North Carolina hardwood
so
markets and softwoods.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, my tally sheets have over 12 different, you know, species on them commonly.
Really?
That we're tallying in the woods that, you know. But if I go out to Montana and Idaho, it's... Typically, those crews are one to two, three species.
We're talking to John Shipley, and this is Let's Talk Land with Lou Jewell. Thank you. So let's talk about some of the definitions and types of forestry just for some background, John. So forestry is defined as a theory and a practice of all that constitutes the creation, conservation, and scientific management of forests and utilization of their resources. It includes all thinking and all actions pertaining to the creation and management of forests, including harvesting, marketing, utilization of all forestry products and services. It also includes not only management of existing forests, but also the creation of new forests. The National Forestry Policy of 1952 recommended that on the basis of functions that all forest lands may be classified into A, protection forest, B, national forest, C, village forest, D, tree forest. National Commission of Agriculture 1976 proposed that the forest can be classified into those different areas. And specifically, just tell us about the different ones. What is a protected forest in the management of?
Yeah, they talk about it being an area that's protected because of its instability of terrain or nature of soil or the geological formations. These kind of areas may not be desirable as a class of protected forest. These forests are located on higher slopes or national parks or sanctuaries mm-hmm. or preservation plots, natural reserves, wilderness areas. They all kind of fall under the protected forest class. They're designed to conserve flora, fauna, soil, and water, especially increasing water yields, reducing floods and droughts, or ameliorating climate conditions. They're there.
Would the conservation easement fall into that category, or is that something separate?
It can be. Okay. It's a protected class of right. of property that's basically donated the development rights. But you can allow forestry harvesting and right. conservation easements. Otherwise, some of them prohibit it, and therefore that would be a protected forest.
Right. But I mean, again, trees are a crop, right? Just like any other thing.
Yeah.
And they really need to be managed and harvested at appropriate times, no matter what their designation is, shouldn't they? Or you've got forests that are 200 years old someplace in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We have some of that, and some of the maybe the natural.
Some of the oldest pinyon pine forests down in Nevada, Salt Lake, at high altitudes. Those things have been dated back over 1,300 years old.
Wow, it's redwoods.
It's the oldest living organism on the planet.
Really?
Yep.
Wow, and that's your redwood species? Or is it...
No, this is what they call a jack pinyon pine. It's they're basically as wide as they are tall.
Huh.
You know, they'll have like a 20-foot canopy on them, and they may only be 20 feet tall. They're spindly and real thick trunked and live on these high altitude plateaus and very dry air, you know, areas that receive 14 inches of rain, basically right. how much rain we've had in the last two months over a whole year. Yeah. You know,
So they never used them. There was no actual use for them, other than
not those
firewood.
Not those. There's
so that's why they've been living around.
Yeah, they've been around a long time.
Yeah. I have some friends like that. They're useless. Okay, then your second category is the production forest. Tell us about that.
These are the ones I most commonly deal with. These are your forest lands that are, you know, serve a use for providing the landowner with, maybe they're a farmer. Maybe they need, you know, fuel wood, or they need timber supply for their right. farms, or they want to sell the timber.
Or expand their crop area.
Yep. I mean, it could also be, you know, forest produce. It could be a forest of pecan trees or black walnuts. Or.
Gotcha.
It could be a plantation of English oak trees and hazelnuts, and they're growing, you know, truffles off their roots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do have truffle farms in the area.
Yeah, we do.
I've sold a couple.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the first truffle guy that sold him land in East Bend that I know of in North Carolina, the spore doctor came from NC State. He's the inoculator. Inoculated the filber tree mm-hmm. or the oak tree. Mm-hmm. The roots when they were young to set the spores to create the truffles. It's kind of interesting.
That's fascinating.
So industrial forest, what's that?
Industrial, you know, it's kind of falls in the same category as production, but they're I guess objectives are a little more narrow because mm-hmm. they're trying to, you know, manage for, you know, producing that mill supply, constant supply of wood and biomaterial. Right. So they're not, you know, as concerned with, you know, what some other landowners may say, oh, well, I got to have my walking trails, or, you know, oh, I really like this stand of oak trees for my squirrel hunting.
Right.
I like to manage it for that. They're not as broad focus as that. They're very narrow supply in the mill. So those kind of typically fall in the industrial forest land.
Then you have the mixed quality forests and the valuable forests and the inaccessible forests. How does that relate?
That's the first time I've ever seen that.
Well, I got you on one, John.
Yeah.
Hey, Rodney, I got him on one.
Yeah, that's basically they've classified industrial forests into three subcategories of mixed quality and valuable and inaccessible forest. That's a good way of breaking it up to try to narrow down your net of management on your properties that you're managing.
Gotcha. Then your social forest. Is that where you go play in the woods?
I think that's basically trying to describe when you have a forest in an urban setting. And a population of people that use it. So a social forest is trying to meet a whole gamut of needs. Right. You know, your walkers, your
park and recreation.
And I have worked with city and state parks on several cases that, you know, they got to go in and do some timber harvesting because some of them are dying and it's becoming a liability.
Or storms. Storm causes damage.
Yeah, I've been an expert witness in a case that revolved around a tree falling on a woman, and yeah, it didn't end well for the lady. But yeah, it all comes down to managing those forests and making sure those trees are healthy,
right?
Because you know, windstorm can do damage.
So how do you determine a tree is healthy? I mean, just visually, or are you doing borings? Or
you can see, well, it could be as common as just looking up in the treetop and see a bunch of dead branches.
Right.
But some of those are a little more harder to pick up on. You start seeing growths on the side of the tree, or you can kind of see a change in bark color. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of it being a red oak, you know, the kind of reddish brown hue down this trunk, you'll see blotches of tan. In black spots in the middle.
And that's usually where the core of the roots are rotting normally?
That's the most likely indicator that the core of the tree is rotting.
Right.
You can look for small holes that can indicate an insect infestation problem.
See that more in pines, don't you, than hardwoods?
No, we got a terrible emerald ash borer that's coming down into North Carolina now by way of Virginia. That's wiping out every single ash tree.
Really?
So if you're in the Piedmont, North Carolina, and you're listening to this, and you have an ash tree, I'm sorry to say that your days are numbered. That ash tree's days are numbered.
There's no...
every year, that's growing pesticide, rapidly.
No pesticide or anything?
No. We can't do anything to stop it.
Another type of insect?
I wish.
Sounds like NC State needs to start working on that.
I'm sure they have.
I bet they are.
Yeah.
And a few others, too.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the most valuable wood, right? But it is part of the...
No, ash is on up there. Ash is...
What's it used for, mostly?
Oh, gosh.
End product.
I could start off and name one that comes to mind as a baseball bat.
Really? But
that doesn't lend to the tree being a very valuable species. And of course, it has a lot of other uses that I just don't know.
Yeah, that's fine.
But my office one time was... The flooring was made out of ash. So it's hard enough to, you know, be basil bat and
it's
flooring.
Considered a hardwood, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a very clear, white lumber. So, but yeah, they're valuable. They're most commonly seen in bottomland hardwood situations.
Okay.
So around here, we don't have a whole lot of them because we don't have a whole lot of bottomland hardwoods like you'd find in the coastal plains where the ground is typically less topography and a little flatter, and the water doesn't go anywhere, and you end up with these wetter soils, and that's very conducive for green ash production.
Interesting. Shadow, we're learning stuff. And then you got your community forests, and they say that's a practice of forests of lands outside the conventional forest area for the benefit of the local populations called the community forest. Community forest seeks to involve the community in the creation and management of such forests. And then your farm forest, what's that?
It's basically, if you can have a wood, what they call, it's a more common term in the Midwest. We really don't talk much about this here in North Carolina because for us, you know, you stop bush hogging or disking the ground, it grows back into a forest overnight.
Right.
Whereas some places in the Midwest or out west, the western states, they what they describe as a woodlot. So you have, you know, these square tracts of land,
right.
You know, square section.
Right, as opposed to meets and bounds. Yeah,
and they'll have a woodlot for growing trees, kind of break the wind, or they're trying to grow it for fuel, mm-hmm. wood fuel. They're just trying to diversify their farm and try to grow some trees for
what type
production.
Of trees are those usually, do you know?
You know, I spend a whole lot of time out there. I really can't speak very intelligently about it, but ones I have seen out there have been everything from aspen to white oak to jack pine.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen walnuts. I've seen ash trees growing this way. Yeah.
Then you've got the extension forest, which includes the activity of raising trees on farmlands, villages, wastelands, community forest areas, and lands along the sides of roads, canal banks, and railway lines. Most recently, they've been emphasized on the dynamic land use planning, and efforts are made to maximize the production of farmland under the agroforestry. And then what's agroforestry?
This is a fun one. This has kind of become more popular in recent years. Whereas we had gone decades with almost no one implementing agroforestry activity, but the basis of it is you're trying to manage trees and sustainable grazing land all together. Now, of course, out west, that's pretty common, but
right.
Here in North Carolina, growing a plantation loblolly pine and having grazing is almost non-existent,
right.
But there's a lot of professors and extension foresters out there who work for the state of North Carolina mm-hmm. and the Forest Service that are trying to push it on landowners because it's going to fit their objectives because you've got a farmer,
right.
He's got this patch of pine trees. He prefers to chop it all down and so he can turn goats on it or cattle.
Right.
The Forest Service may go up to him like, hey, well, why don't we think about this? Maybe we can have both. So it's great.
They're looking for shade, right? Is that kind of what the reason is for it?
No, the reason is so that you can grow, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have your forest and you have your grazing all in the same acre, you know? So it's not the best grazing land. No, it's not the best forest land because you have fewer stems an acre.
Right.
But it's a cool dynamic, right? You know, it's a savannah type forest. It's open. It's pretty to walk through. You got you got enough sunlight going through the canopy to provide grasses for grazing.
Yeah.
So.
And then your recreational forestry.
Yeah, and this kind of falls back to landowner's objectives. If you have a landowner who's all into recreating on the property, and that's his primary, you know, use of it,
mm-hmm.
and forestry is secondary.
Right.
You kind of have to play with that and try to find a happy medium to still allow those recreational activities and to, you know, expand upon those while still trying to practice forestry. And this may involve, you know, very limited harvesting.
Mm-hmm. Open up corridors for critters and trails and so on.
Taking out diseased trees
and
crooked trees. And honestly, this is probably one of the more common situation I end up with.
Right now, 2018... in the United States, recreational land is the hottest land product out there.
I believe it.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, we sell a lot of that, and I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
Multi-purpose, where you got the investor, and, you know, they like to hunt and be out in nature, and, you know, and they've got extra money. Instead of putting it in a CD or something, they go buy, you know, 100 acres of land or 50 acres of land and get a little hunting group together and put a little cabin on it and watch their trees grow because
mm-hmm.
they're getting a return on their investment because all land is an investment. So that right now is the hottest thing out there. Just a little history kind of switch off there. We covered the different types there. You know, it says logging arose when settlers first arrived in Jamestown in 1607, and since they formed a booming economic structure, logging has become incredibly important when the need of shipbuilding became more frequent. In fact, in the 1790s, New England was exporting about 36 million feet of pine boards, you can relate to that, and at least 300 ship masts per year. So especially here in North Carolina, because we had the pine, and of course the pine created the pitch, they called it, which was the sap, and of course that was your that was to seal your logs to keep your boat from sinking.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually exported in the early centuries more timber because of the tremendous amount of timber we had, as opposed to England and some of the other countries where, you know, over the centuries they cut all the trees for firewood and building. You know, you go over there to Scotland and places, you know, it's beautiful. It's just absolutely gorgeous. But it's because of the, you know, the utilization and history of utilizing trees for other things, and they didn't plant them back. There was no forestry management.
Yeah.
It's my understanding, you can clarify this, John, is that we actually have more trees in the United States today than when the settlers came. Is that fair?
That's because my understanding.
Mm-hmm. And we're huge in forestry management. That's one of our largest industries in terms of value in dollars in the country. The logging industry is also busy in the demand of New England area regularly shipping lumber and products elsewhere. And with the start of the Industrial Revolution, the demand for lumber generally spiked during the 1830s, Bangor, Maine became the world's biggest lumber supporting port in the United States. It's true that we have more standing timber, which we just talked about, in the U.S. than the 1600s. So let's talk a little bit about timber as one of the most important assets a landowner, and why our listeners should know why it's so important. So how do you value timber? And I know that is a big open question, but
yeah.
But there's just in general, I mean, you know, well, can you speak to that?
A lot of landowners will try to value their timber based on what they read on Google. Well,
uh-oh.
It's not that easy.
Yeah, I'd say.
It all, you know, grade, you know, logistics to the mill, topography and access, and how much the logger is going to charge the mill to cut it. Of course, the ever-changing markets.
Right.
The demand for those trees at the mill. Maybe the mill's got enough of them, doesn't need it. They put them all on, on quotas. For us, you know, we have timber sales several times a month, and we know what those species are bringing in different areas of the Piedmont and some of the mountains. And we can kind of use that to gauge the next track of timber we're going to sell. We can say, well, we know what this is going on here, and these prices are happening now, and you can kind of do an assimilation to come up with the value, and that's going to be dependent upon the timber crews.
Yeah.
You know, the timber crews is what's there to actually estimate.
So the answer to the question is, it depends.
It depends.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what I say in class when people say, what's timber worth? I say, it depends.
There's
so many variables.
Yep.
It's hard just to pinpoint it, but like you just mentioned. So what's a timber cruise when you talk about a timber cruise, and kind of how do you figure board feet? And I think there's several different methodologies of doing that.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways. Most commonly, we're going through that forest and we're measuring the diameter at 4.5 feet above the ground. So we get a diameter measurement.
Is that with a round tape measure, or is that with a ruler?
We wrap a tape, and the tape actually tells diameter, believe it or not. I don't have to sit in the woods and do a calculation to convert circumference to diameter, but it does it for me.
Gotcha.
And then I measure the tree height, the merchantable height. Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe it's the first limb, and maybe it's the first big limb. Maybe it's down to a 10-inch top or an 8-inch diameter top.
Right.
Depends on the species and product in different markets. We look at that. Once we have those two measurements, we enter them into a calculator of some sort.
You have a chart. You know,
yeah,
you
a chart.
10 inches, 12 inches, 14 inches in the species.
And then it spits out the basic volume that's
in
that tree.
Do this on a computer? On a handheld?
It's in a computer.
In the old days, it was a chart, you know, that you took a pencil there and you just put tick mark.
Out in the woods, still a chart's being used just to understand it when you're out there in the woods. But basically, when you get down through timber crews, then you run the calculations through your computer, and that spits out the estimates of how much white oak and how much red oak and how much grade. And
when you're doing a prism, that's where you actually plot an area, like 100 feet by 100 feet or whatever that is. You're actually looking through a glass that has a scale in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not actually measuring each tree. You're averaging. And you can spot measure. You don't have to do the whole 50 acres.
That's what's called a basal area plot.
Yeah.
If we're doing a loblolly pine thinning, we're going to be thinning to a basal area. That's a basic representation of how much cross-sectional area those trees represent in a given stand of trees. It's I can go into it. It's going to bore you, but
no, basically,
it's used in management of a forest to understand the basic volume yields.
And then determining the quantity and the board feet, that's when you get back in the office and you start calculating, and then you've got different books that are published, right, that you use based on. What's that about?
Are you talking about market reports?
Right.
Sometimes we can use those, and sometimes you just throw them out the window. They're no.
Experience pays, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
The heck with all that stuff, right?
Sometimes it doesn't make a heck of a lot of beans. Right. If the market reports and some mill's got to have the wood, they're going to pay for it.
It's like me and you. I mean, with your experience, I have a little bit more. But, you know, I can pretty much, you know, go out and look at a 50-acre track or a 10-acre track or whatever it is, and I can pretty much give you a value of what that land's going to bring without having to go into MLS and do all the CMAs and all the other stuff. It's just experience. You do it for a long time, and you build that base of knowledge and look at where the market is and location and so on. Is there an active buying market and right now, I'd say?
Yeah.
Are we having problem finding people?
I don't think
it's a good time to sell, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. In our business right now, in this sawmill and export market, lumber market, domestic lumber market, whatever, I think the market's probably never been stronger across the board.
Time to sell then, huh?
Yeah, hardwood's doing really well. Like I said earlier, you know, pine's not as high as it used to be in 2005, and, you know, we may never see those levels again, but the demand is as strong as ever.
Right. So, hardwoods and softwoods, obviously your softwoods are going to bring less per board foot normally than your hardwoods, right? And also when you plant, I guess here's my question I was looking for, is when a seedling on a hardwood comes out of the ground, it's about an 80-acre cycle average for that tree to mature to its fullest, about 80 years, where on your softwoods it may be 30, 40 years, 50 years. Is that, you give me.
Yeah, that's just pretty generalization. You know, but it could be.
I know that'll vary, but just as a, you know, as a thumbnail. And then in terms of living 80 years old, you know, if you plant a hardwood forest, you know, you get to cut it probably one time in your lifetime, right?
Right.
But this is my point. If you got a softwood, you may be able to cut it as much as three times, right?
Or you're doing selective harvesting. You're cutting every 20 years in a hardwood stand.
Yeah.
So all depends.
How is an owner paid?
Most commonly lump sum. They paid up front when they award the timber buyer with the timber deed. It's handled like a real estate closing in which you have an attorney involved and they prepare a timber deed. The closing attorney also prepares a title search to make sure there's no liens against the property.
Yeah, sure.
And the landowner can convey equitable interest of the trees. Right. Then the timber deed is awarded to the buyer and they hold that timber deed for 2 years. Commonly.
Normally, that's negotiable, right? But it's normally contracts 2 years.
Yeah,
it could be less, it could be more, right?
Depending. And then the landowner gets paid.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then if you're doing it, selling it on the load, that's being paid differently. But you still have a timber deed, is that not right?
Sometimes you do. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's called just a stumpage purchase agreement, and it's just a written agreement. And
between the buyer and the buyer.
Yeah, because when it's sold by the unit or by the week to a mill, it's actually in North Carolina law, you're actually conveying interest in a personal property instead of an asset of the land.
Can you sell your contract? I just did a timber deed, okay, and I own a piece of land, but I got it up for sale. And I've got to convey to whomever that buyer is that I've sold the timber, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you can sell the land without the timber rights.
Right. So sometimes land's conveyed, and the timber rights are still there, and the timber's standing, and then, you know, you move in, and the next thing you know, here's the logging trucks, and saying, we're cutting the timber, have a nice day. Okay. Then you get into situations where you have to get court order easements because of the accessibility, mostly on landlocked land. You'll see this where sometimes you can force a sale. The government can come in and say, you know, it's a crop, and we're going to give an outlet, right? Have you experienced that?
Yeah.
It's not that
tricky,
common.
It's not black and white.
Right.
How the law is going to interpret what access that there is property that you're trying to cut the trees on. Or
that could be aggravating, couldn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a possibility. It's worth exploring, especially if it's got a valuable timber crop, you know.
Darn right. Yeah. You know, and helicopter logging does exist.
Really? In this area?
Sometimes.
Where do you see that more in the
mountains?
Blue Ridge and foothills? Yeah.
High-value trees on very remote land.
So we mentioned this earlier. Usually when you have a mortgage on the property and you're selling off the asset, okay, i.e., either cutting off a parcel of land, say you own 50 acres and you sell off 10, and you've got a mortgage, that lender has a deed of trust, and you've just reduced the value that's collateralized to that mortgage. So if you're selling off a portion of the land or selling the timber asset, then, you know, you definitely want to have a conversation with your lender, because you're thinking you're going to get that $80,000 check when that deed signed, that timber deed signed, and you find out the bank's going to say, well, I want about 50% of that or 80% of that.
Oh, yeah, darn right.
Yeah, and then you got taxes to pay on top of it. So, you know, you need to kind of know what you're doing. What does cutting timber do to the marketability and the value of land?
If someone's going to sell the land, then they don't need to be going out there and cutting the trees first.
Right.
My opinion.
I agree.
Sell it. Sell with the trees on it.
Yeah. Because I think at least what I've used, and you may use something different from the appraisers, okay, especially Carolina Farms, which is the farm lenders, and from other appraisal sources, and from the asset managers at the county, the tax assessors. I'm using $1,500 to $1,800 on a clear-cut tract of land.
Yeah.
Again, depending on where it is, accessibility, the topography, and so on. But, you know, I could have sold that land for $5,000 or $6,000 an acre, and maybe I sold the trees off and got $3,000 an acre because it's a pretty good stand, and now I'm trying to resell it, and, you know, and which is hard to do because, you know, it takes a long time for that undergrowth to grow into trees to create a canopy. And it may be 15 years before you can walk the property, other than the logging trails.
Yep.
So it's a different type of thing. What's a, just real quick, a forestry deferment. We have that here in this area. If you have 20 acres or more of certified timber, then, you know, you can have that deferred.
Yeah, the deferred use value program is offered in every county in North Carolina.
Right.
And that lets the landowner take advantage in annual tax savings that will greatly reduce their annual property taxes because they are practicing forestry. In order to be in that program, you got to have 20 acres or more of forest land.
And it has to be certified by a consulting forester or a state forester.
Yep, one of the two.
Yeah. And, and I think that's updated every 5 years, requirement kind of.
It depends on the county.
Yeah. They want to get a look at it. Hey, John, you know, it's been a real pleasure to have you. You're a great friend, and I love working with you. We do a lot
of business. Thanks, Lou. Yeah.
You help me make a lot of money. And I hope people listening to the show today, give them a commercial. How do they get in touch with
you? You can find us by Googling Carolina Forestry or Forestry North Carolina, and we'll be on the first page. But we're
what's your website?
CarolinaForestry.com.
What's your telephone number?
336-416-6384.
Say it one more time.
336-416-6384.
Your email address?
Email is johns@carolinaforestry.com.
Great. John, thank you for being here.
Thank you,
Lou.
Great
show. You know, Rodney, how did they find us?
They can go to our website. Go to WKT1090.com and click on right there, Land Pro Doctor and Land Pro. I don't think my mic's working now.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
So now I'm going to have to tell them.
Yes.
So then go to our radio app, right?
Simple radio app.
Super radio app, okay? And what's the name of that app?
Simple radio app.
Simple radio app, okay? Or you can listen to our show.
Yeah, every Saturday morning from 7 to 8 a.m.
Boy, you have to get up early, don't you?
Yeah,
if they should be up anyway.
Yeah, that's right. We're always up early.
Okay.
Yeah, if they can't catch it on Saturday mornings here at the radio, but you've got it linked up to some other ways they can get it.
We download our shows after they're broadcast every week. on a website called www.letstalkland.net.
Mm-hmm.
And we also now have it in podcast format on Spotify and Podbean, and we've got some of our shows on YouTube, LinkedIn, and Facebook. So thank you for joining us today. Let us know if you like the show. If you have any guests or topics that we'd like to suggest, we'd appreciate them. All questions are welcome, and all of our guests may be emailed with questions or concerns as well. This is a show for the public and, most importantly, for the real estate agents who do not have a source for land education. Our shows are www.letstalkland, as I mentioned. My email is lou@mylandpro.com. My cell number is 336-669-1405. See you next week.